This is a recording of The Treason of the Geographers, Mythical Mesoamerican Conspiracy and the Book of Mormon by Matthew Roper, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Mormon Scripture, read by Matthew Roper. The Lost City of Zarahemla, from Iowa to Guatemala and back again, is the latest manifestation of an ideological movement currently popular on the periphery of Mormon culture. John Neville, an attorney and part-time novelist, has spun a tale of conspiracy that may tantalize some readers, but is more fiction than history. The argument that Joseph Smith knew the details of Book of Mormon geography through Revelation is not new, but the claim that there was a conspiracy while the prophet was still alive to oppose a revealed geography is a notable innovation. Neville claims that what he calls the limited Mesoamerican geography originates in dissident Mormon circles, beginning with Benjamin Winchester, an early convert and writer who left the church after the death of Joseph Smith. He claims that three unsigned editorials on Central America and the Book of Mormon, published in the Times and Seasons on September 15th and October 1st, 1842, were written by Winchester rather than Joseph Smith and close associates, as some scholars believe. According to Neville, the articles are momentous because they place Book of Mormon events in Mesoamerica, specifically Guatemala. The articles are unusual because the Central American identification is at variance with other statements Joseph made placing Book of Mormon events in North America. The publication of these articles was part of an elaborate scheme to get Winchester's controversial ideas about the Book of Mormon in print. He writes, "In March 1841, the prophet Joseph Smith received a revelation naming the area of Iowa, across from Nauvoo, as Zarahemla. That same month, the man Joseph described as rotten at heart, who would injure the church as much as he could, began a scheme to move Zarahemla to Guatemala. His efforts culminated in an article in the church's Times and Seasons on 1 October 1842. From that date until now, this man's scheme has succeeded." Neville claims that Winchester, motivated by excessive zeal and convinced that his new idea would win more converts to the church, conspired to get his ideas accepted and published. This new interpretation, Neville insists, contradicted Joseph Smith's revelations that established that the Book of Mormon took place in North America and not Central or South America. He claims that the Mesoamerican theory of Book of Mormon geography has resulted in a number of evils that have hurt the church, undermined faith in Joseph Smith's prophetic calling, and continues to have a baleful effect on its members. The negative impact of Winchester's Mesoamerican approach, the evils that may result therefrom, may have started in the 1840s, but it continues today, perhaps more than ever. It permeates church publications, including the Ensign and church manuals. Neville decries the widespread depiction of a Mayan influence, such as the Freeburg paintings and numerous related books, videos, and even package tours. Other evils include essays addressing challenging issues on the Book of Mormon recently made available on the church website, which make reference to the unsigned Times and Seasons editorials on Central America and the work of LDS scholars who support a Mesoamerican interpretation, and also church-approved artwork depicting the resurrected Savior's visit to the Nephites in a Mesoamerican setting. Even today, 174 years later, in the year 2015, the negative influence of Mesoamerican ideas is seen inside every one of the church's thousands of chapels around the world. "But not to fear," writes Neville, "replacing Mesoamerica with North America will strengthen the faith of members, encourage missionaries, and remove an unnecessary stumbling block for investigators." Lost City reflects a heartland ideology in need of a villain, and Neville seeks to make Winchester the scapegoat for what he considers an original sin of Mesoamerican geography. "Although this is not a criminal case," Neville writes, "I pretended it was." Neville's placement of his arguments within the adversarial context of a courtroom invites the case for the defense. This requires a wider range than the specifics of Neville's conspiracy theory and an examination of the assumptions he has made about the nature of Revelation and Joseph Smith that do not fit known historical facts. I will cover the important background in three articles. Each will examine a different facet of Joseph Smith's connection with ideas about Book of Mormon geography and correlations with Central America. 1. Neville presents his case under the presumption that a crime was committed. In order to commit a crime against a revealed geography, there should be evidence for such a revelation. If not, there was no crime to begin with, and the effort to establish means, motive, and opportunity is irrelevant. This article will address two issues. First, what did Joseph Smith believe about Book of Mormon geography? Were Joseph Smith's views, insofar as they can be known to us, based upon revelation, his own opinions, or a combination of both? Second, what exactly is a Mesoamerican geography? Does it constitute a believable motive for Winchester's theoretical scheme? Neville's argument rests on a fundamental misunderstanding of early geographical interpretations that requires correction and clarification. 2. Once the background context has been established, I will discuss the implications for Neville's theoretical conspiracy. A second article will discuss the influence of Stevens and Catherwood's 1841 publication of Incidents of Travel in Central America on early thinking about the Book of Mormon, including that of Joseph Smith. 3. Having laid this historical foundation, a third article will then revisit the question of who authored the unsigned editorials in 1842. We will expand our pool of potential candidates for the authorship of those articles to include Benjamin Winchester and others in order to evaluate Neville's claims and then discuss the implications of our findings. Neville argues that the idea that Joseph Smith may not have been an expert on geographical information in the text of the Book of Mormon, that he may have had and expressed opinions and drew his own deductions about some matters, such as geography, is evil, and undermines faith in the prophet's calling as prophet, seer, and revelator. He insists that because the prophet spoke with angelic messengers, translated the Book of Mormon, and later went through the manuscript and made corrections to the text, that he was an expert on the meaning of the text. The issue of what Joseph knew about Book of Mormon geography ought to be approached as a research question, not a theological given. Neville insists that Joseph knew, but did not tell, or perhaps could not tell. But how can Neville know what Joseph knew if Joseph didn't say? Latter-day Saint scripture suggests that prophets and seers received many revelations, but sometimes, for various reasons, did not always fully understand what the Lord had given them. Lehi saw the tree of life and much else in vision. Nephi saw things that his father saw. When his brothers asked Nephi to explain one of the geographical features of the vision, the river, Nephi said it represented filthiness. And so much was his father's mind swallowed up in other things that he beheld not the filthiness of the water. Nephi's comment clarifies that even those who receive revelations may not fully understand or be prepared and able to interpret every aspect of them. Alma's teachings to Corianton about resurrection of the body provide additional insight. Alma was careful to distinguish between what the Lord had revealed to him and what he had not. He knew of certain things only because he had made them a matter of diligent and persistent inquiry. He did not know the times appointed for the resurrection of the body, but in the absence of more detailed information from God on the matter, saw nothing improper about expressing an opinion about it. Writing with the wisdom of personal experience, Joseph Smith taught the saints that it is a great thing to inquire at the hand of God, or to come into his presence. And we feel fearful to approach him on subjects that are of little or no consequence to satisfy the inquiries of individuals. There's nothing wrong with the study of Book of Mormon geography, and careful study of the text rewards the reader, as many can attest. But in the Lord's eyes, the need for revelation on the location of Zarahemla might not fall high on the spectrum of our eternal priorities. One might even be inclined to apply Alma's teachings on faith to the geography of the Book of Mormon. How much more cursed is he that knoweth than he that only believeth, or hath cause to believe, and falleth into transgression. The privilege we have to read the Book of Mormon, to carefully study the text, and develop our tentative and often faulty opinions is a blessing if it leads us to follow its teachings. Speaking of her husband's activities during the translation of the Book of Mormon, Emma Smith remembered, One time, while he was translating, he stopped suddenly, pale as a sheet, and said, "Emma, did Jerusalem have walls around it?" When I answered yes, he replied, "Oh, I was afraid I had been deceived." He had such limited knowledge of history at that time that he did not even know that Jerusalem was surrounded by walls. This passage is interesting for what it suggests about the difference between a text, even a text revealed through the gift and power of God, and its meaning. Joseph is reading the text of the Book of Mormon from the seer stone to his scribe. He sees the words on the stone, and then wonders if there was some mistake when it speaks of the walls of Jerusalem. He only knows about the walls of the city because the text says so. He has not seen a vision of the walls of Jerusalem. He is a first-hand witness of the revealed text, but has no knowledge of its geographical accuracy beyond the report of Emma, who has heard of or read about the walls of Jerusalem, but never been there herself. The text is divinely revealed, but for geographical understanding, Joseph is dependent upon the potentially fallible human source. It is asserted by one of his principal followers, wrote one early critic with amazement, that even Joe at this day is profoundly ignorant of the meaning of many of the words contained in the Book of Mormon. For this critic, that idea seems scandalous. But for Emma and the saints, these intellectual limitations were evidence that the Book of Mormon translation was the work of God, not a fictional product of Joseph Smith's imagination. When left to his own, Joseph Smith was just as prone as any of us to make mistakes and sometimes express faulty opinions. Sometimes the Lord would correct him. Sometimes he did not. According to one report, Joseph Smith said to the Ells and to the congregation that he for a length of time thought on phrenology and that he had a revelation, the Lord rebuking him sharply in crediting such a thing, and further said there was no reality in such a science, but was the works of the devil. In an interview with a reporter in 1843, the prophet shared additional insight relating to his role as a prophet and a revelator. Speaking of revelations, he stated that when he was in a quandary, he asked the Lord for revelation, and when he could not get it, he followed the dictates of his own judgment, which were as good as revelation to him. But he never gave anything to his people as revelation unless it was revelation, and the Lord did reveal himself to him. Joseph received revelations from God, but he did not always get a revelation when he asked for one. There would be no need for the prophet to call attention to divine communication if everything he said was revelation. At those times when revelation on a question was not forthcoming, he said he used the dictates of his own judgment, which generally served him well, but were of course still his own, not God's. Jesse Crosby, an early convert, said that he once went with some friends to ask Brother Joseph his opinion on a public matter. He told them he did not enjoy the right vouchsafed to every American citizen, that of free speech. He said to them that when he ventured to give his private opinion on any subject of importance, his words were often garbled and their meaning twisted and then given out as the word of the Lord because they came from him. The fact that most of what Joseph said does not come to us firsthand, but through the accounts and recollections of others, suggests the need for caution in our interpretation of secondary historical sources. Neville cites the account of Joseph Smith's mother, Lucy Mack Smith, suggesting Joseph Smith's revelatory knowledge of some aspects of Nephite culture. This account, Neville writes, remains the most comprehensive description of Joseph Smith's familiarity with Book of Mormon culture and setting. Lucy wrote her recollection of these evening conversations just over two decades after the events they describe. She recalled, "In the course of our evening conversations, Joseph would give us some of the most amusing recitals which could be imagined. He would describe the ancient inhabitants of this continent, their dress, their manner of traveling, the animals which they rode, the cities that were built by them, the structure of their buildings, with every particular of their mode of warfare, their religious worship, as particularly as though he had spent his life with them. If the Lord revealed certain things to the prophet about ancient Book of Mormon people and culture, did this include the details of Book of Mormon geography? It is worth observing that while Lucy wrote some of the cultural elements that Joseph seemed to be familiar with, geography is not one that she mentioned. Being the translator, even an inspired translator of an ancient text, does not necessarily make one an expert on the geography of that text. Joseph was surprised when he learned that Jerusalem had walls. This suggests that he could be as surprised by the text as we might be. If the Lord saw fit to reveal the details of geography to Joseph Smith, he could, of course, do so. Yet one could also conceivably see a rock, a tree, a building, a city, or a man in vision, and yet not know or fully understand the surrounding geographical details. At the time the Book of Mormon came forth, it conflicted with popular perceptions of Native American culture. David Whitmer, one of the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon, remembered the challenge this seemed to pose. As reported in an interview with a reporter for the Chicago Times, when they were first commanded to testify of these things, they demurred and told the Lord the people would not believe them. For the book concerning which they were to bear record told of the people who were educated and refined, dwelling in large cities, whereas all that was then known of the early inhabitants of this country was the filthy, lazy, degraded, and ignorant savages that were roaming over the land. The Lord told us in reply that he would make it known to the people that the early inhabitants of this land had been just such a people as they were described in the book, and he would lead them to discover the ruins of great cities, and they should have abundant evidence of the truth of which is written in the book, all of which, said Mr. Whitmer, has been fulfilled to the very letter. Whitmer's recollection is of interest in light of Mother Smith's comments about Joseph Smith's evening conversations. The earliest Latter-day Saints, in their writings, referred to mounds and what some took to be the remains of Indian forts and small buildings and other structures as evidence for pre-Columbian civilization. No Latter-day Saint writer mentioned large pre-Columbian cities until 1833, when W.W. Phelps published a brief report of the ruins of Otulum, or Palenque, in Central America. That report described the ruins of a city as extending 20 miles, a claim later proved to be exaggerated, and the remains of a palace and other buildings with sculptured human figures. The neighboring country, for many leagues distant, contains remains of ancient labors of its peoples, and bridges, reservoirs, monumental inscriptions, subterranean edifices, etc. It is reasonable to assume that Whitmer, who lived in Jackson County, Missouri, knew of this report. This article and subsequent discoveries by Stevens and Catherwood would have confirmed the Lord's promise to the Book of Mormon witnesses. In this context, Lucy's reference to the cities that were built, the structure of their buildings, and their mode of warfare could explain Joseph Smith's later interest in incidents of travel in Central America. Neville cites the 1834 account of Zelph from the published History of the Church as evidence that Joseph Smith opposed placing Book of Mormon events in Mesoamerica. In citing that account, Neville gives no historical background for this story or the sources it is based on. There is, for example, no reference to Ken Godfrey's essential study. The entry on Zelph in the published History of the Church was not written by Joseph Smith and is not a contemporary account, but is a hodgepodge of seven documents written by other men in Zion's camp who wrote about the event. When examined, these sources leave many issues unclear, including who exactly Zelph was, whether he had anything to do with the lands or events described in the Book of Mormon text, or if he lived at a much later time. As historian Ken Godfrey concludes, if the history of the church were to be revised today using modern historical standards, readers would be informed that Joseph Smith wrote nothing about the discovery of Zelph, and that the account of uncovering the skeleton in Pike County is based on the diaries of seven members of Zion's camp, some of which were written long after the event took place. We would be assured that the members of Zion's camp dug up a skeleton near the Illinois River in early June 1834. Equally sure is that Joseph Smith made statements about the deceased person and his historical setting. We would learn that it is unclear which statements attributed to him derived from his vision, as opposed to being implied or surmised either by him or by others. Nothing in the diary suggests that the mound itself was discovered by revelation. Furthermore, readers would be told that most sources agree that Zelph was a white Lamanite who fought under a leader named Onondagus, variously spelled. Beyond that, what Joseph said to his men is not entirely clear, judging by the variations in the available sources. The date of the man Zelph, too, remains unclear. Expressions such as great struggles among the Lamanites, if accurately reported, could refer to a period long after the close of the Book of Mormon narrative, as well as to the 4th century AD. None of the sources before the Willard Richards composition, however, actually says that Zelph died in battle with the Nephites, only that he died in battle when the otherwise unidentified people of Onondagus were engaged in great wars among the Lamanites. Zelph was identified as a Lamanite, a label agreed on by all the accounts. This term might refer to the ethnic and cultural category spoken of in the Book of Mormon as actors in the destruction of the Nephites, or it might refer more generally to a descendant of the early Lamanites and could have been considered in 1834 the equivalent of Indian. See, for example, Doctrine and Covenants 3:18, 20, 10:48, 28:8, and 32:2. Nothing in the accounts can settle the question of Zelph's specific ethnic identity. The issue, again, is not whether Joseph Smith received revelation on the warrior named Zelph. That much seems clear from the historical sources. But if what he learned in that revelation had anything to do with the geography of the scriptural text. On that question, precise language of the prophet would make a difference. But the historical sources do not allow us to determine with clarity his precise language, or if some of the language recorded in these secondary sources reflected Joseph's own opinions or those of others. Neville was fully aware of this background on Zelph, including what I had written about it in 2010, well before the publication of Lost City in late February 2015. It is very disappointing that he only cites the passage on Zelph from the history of the church without addressing the work and arguments of historians. This is misleading, but follows an unfortunate pattern set by others in the so-called Heartland movement. In 2007, Rodney Meldrum began distributing DVDs promoting his so-called Heartland theory of the Book of Mormon. In the series, he cited statements from Ken Godfrey, John Sorensen, and myself, which he characterized as undermining Joseph Smith's inspired prophetic teachings. In 2008, a detailed response to Meldrum's claims was made available through FAIR, which included a discussion of the Zelph issue. In 2009, Meldrum published a book, Prophecies and Promises, the Book of Mormon and the United States of America, in which he repeated much of what he taught in his DVDs and continued to cite the Zelph story in the history of the church to support his claims about Joseph Smith's revelations, including the details of Book of Mormon geography. On March 11, 2010, I wrote to Rod Meldrum and asked him why he continued to cite the current history of the church version of the Zelph story as authoritative and supportive of his claims, without addressing or acknowledging that it was not written by Joseph Smith. I referred him to the articles written by Ken Godfrey discussing the sources on Zelph. "Why," I asked him, "do you claim, based upon what he has written, that Godfrey questions or attempts to discredit the inspired words of Joseph Smith and cast doubt on the validity of Joseph Smith's inspiration?" I then explained my concerns. If you previously read Godfrey's work on the Zelph story, you already know that the passage on Zelph in the current edition of the History of the Church has a complex history. For example, in the manuscript history of Joseph Smith, reference to Cumorah and several other words were crossed out in the original manuscript. When the History of the Church was first published in 1904, this was reflected in that edition, where the crossed out words were omitted from the text. It was only later in the second edition that the crossed out words referring to the hill Cumorah in the Zelph story were put back in without any explanation that the words had been crossed out in the original manuscript history. This was also explained to you in a response to your 2007 DVD prepared by FAIR in Section 3, pages 7 to 10 of that work. In your 2009 book, Prophecies and Promises, you again simply cite the most recent edition of the History of the Church on page 106 without any explanation of the history behind this passage, accusing those who disagree with you of dismissing Joseph Smith as a prophet. I must confess that I find this puzzling and a little troubling, as most of your readers would not know that there is more to the story here. Isn't this data important and relevant to the question of what Joseph Smith actually knew, and actually said about Zelph and how it may or may not relate to the Book of Mormon geography. Obviously, people make mistakes and nobody knows everything, but given the subject matter and how hard you come out against those who differ with your interpretations, and the fact that you have been repeatedly provided with information on these questions, I find and I think that many other fair-minded people would find this omission troubling. Meldrum responded the following day, refusing to answer my questions unless I promised to keep his response private. This I refused to do, since the claims and accusations he was making were public and thus required a public explanation and correction. I responded, "In your public presentations, your DVDs, your website, and your publications, you state certain things and make certain claims about what happened in church history and what Joseph Smith knew about Book of Mormon geography. You are also on record stating certain things and making certain claims in public and making insinuations about myself and others and our loyalty to the church, Joseph Smith and his revelations. I do not take such accusations lightly, nor can I, given who I represent at BYU and the Neil E. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship. I do not want to believe that you and your co-author have made these claims and accusations out of malice or other base motives, but some of your claims and statements, frankly, puzzle me, as they seem unsustainable and even reckless. I understand that there may be circumstances in which it would be advisable and perhaps proper to keep correspondence confidential. I don't object to that under certain circumstances. As a general rule and a way of life, however, this is not wise. I am not interested in your personal life. My questions deal specifically with what you have publicly stated, presented, distributed, or published, some of it about me. I was seeking clarification of public things which relate to these issues, which you should, I would think, be willing, perhaps even anxious, to justify or explain. Under such circumstances, why would you want to keep your answers in these rather simple questions confidential? Since it is you and not I who have repeatedly made these things a public matter, it would, I think, be to your advantage to openly respond to my questions and justify why you have said the things that you have, that is, if they can be justified. Afterwards, I wrote an article published in the Farms Review in which I responded to the book Prophecies and Promises. There, I discussed the Zelph issue in detail, but I did not make reference to the above correspondence at that time in the hope that he would address these concerns in a future work. The following year, however, Meldrum published another book, Exploring the Book of Mormon in America's Heartland, A Visual Journey of Discovery. The book contained colored pictures of the Illinois Mound, again citing the same passage from the current edition of the History of the Church, without any further explanation or acknowledgement of Godfrey's work or my article in the Farms Review. Neville's work, now enthusiastically promoted by Rod Meldrum, continues this irresponsible and misleading pattern. Neville claims that Joseph Smith's letter to Emma Smith in June 1834 during Zion's Camp shows that Joseph Smith rejected a Central American geography. In a letter to Emma Smith on June 4, 1834, Joseph wrote, "The whole of our journey in the midst of so large a company of social, honest, and sincere men, wandering over the plains of the Nephites, recounting occasionally the history of the Book of Mormon, roving over the mounds of that once beloved people of the Lord, picking up their skulls and their bones as proof of its divine authenticity." Neville assumes that the phrase plains of the Nephites is a geographical clue to the scriptural text. He reasons it may refer to the plains of Heshlon in the Book of Ether or the plains of Agosh, but that would make them the plains of the Jaredites rather than the plains of the Nephites. As an alternative, he suggests linking Joseph's words to the plains of Nephihah mentioned in Alma 52. This is, of course, total speculation. The plains of the Nephites and the plains of Nephihah may or may not be the same, but certainly need not be. They could just as well be the plains of Onondagas or the plains of Zelph or something else entirely. Any place where the Nephites once lived anywhere in the Americas might qualify. Early Latter-day Saints viewed all Native Americans in North and South America as descendants of the seed of Nephi and his brethren. So the words plains of the Nephites are useless as a clue to external Book of Mormon geography. Perhaps they were not intended to be. It makes more sense to read Joseph's use of Nephite in the letter as a cultural term rather than a geographical clue to the text. In 1838, the prophet received a revelation about Spring Hill in North Missouri, which is now included in section 116 of the Doctrine and Covenants. A great deal of folklore has circulated in the past about this hill, based upon statements of some early associates of the prophet who visited the place. Were the remains of Adam's altar still there? Was there a Nephite altar on the site? Information on the naming of the hill at Adam Onde Amen comes from a document written in Missouri by George W. Robinson, but it was not written by Joseph Smith himself. That entry states, "We came to Colonel Lyman White's, who lives at the foot of Tower Hill, a name appropriated by President Smith, in consequence of the remains of an old Nephitish altar and tower, which was called Spring Hill, a name appropriated by the brethren present, but afterwards named by the mouth of the Lord and was called Adam Onde Amen, because, said he, it is the place where Adam shall come to visit his people, or the Ancient of Days shall sit, as spoken of by Daniel the prophet." Note that the brethren present first found some archaeological remains on the hill that were thought to look Nephitish. A revelation through the prophet Joseph comes afterwards, but says nothing about the validity of any previous Nephitish association, only that Adam once dwelt in the region. That would be long before the Book of Mormon anyway, and that one day there would be a future meeting prophesied by Daniel. Joseph Smith reportedly remarked later that Adam, when he dwelt there thousands of years before, had offered sacrifice, but never appears to have associated any of the extant remains there with Adam, although later brethren speculated about this. Alex Baugh notes, so what did Robinson mean when he said they discovered the remains of a Nephitish structure? It is important to note that early Latter-day Saints clearly believed that Native North American tribes were descendants of earlier Nephite-Lamanite civilization. With this belief, Robinson probably used the word Nephitish to indicate that the structure or altar was built by or originated with the North American Indians. He may have also used Nephitish to mean that the altar was of ancient origin. Therefore, what Robinson was attempting to describe were the remains of what appeared to be a sacred altar structure erected by early Native Americans. This perspective can be seen in the writings of the prophet's close associates from Zion's camp, those social, honest, and sincere men he wrote about to his wife Emma. Orson Pratt, for example, in his brief summary of the Book of Mormon's story, writes that the arts and sciences flourished to a great extent among the Nephites in their days of righteousness, and that they were a civilized, enlightened people. The Lamanites, when they dwelt in unbelief, were not. Pratt describes the Mulekites, who had a corrupted language and lacked any written records, as only in a partial state of civilization, which they rectified when they united with Mosiah's people. Pratt associated Nephites with arts and sciences, written language, and other elements of civilization. Wilford Woodruff, whose journal provides a key source on the Zelph story, was another trusted associate of the prophet. In later years, he visited Arizona and New Mexico, where he encountered firsthand Native American groups of the region. Observed cultural differences led him to think that some of these groups were more Nephite than Lamanite. In a letter to John Taylor in the 12, he shared some of these observations. "I view my visit among the Nephites as one of the most interesting missions of my life. Although short, I say Nephites, because if there are any Nephites on this continent, we have found them among the Zunis, Lagunas, Isletas, who are of a different race of people altogether from the Lamanites. I class the Navajo, the Mokis or Hopi, and the Apache with Lamanites, although they are in advance of many Indian tribes of America. I class the Zunis, the Lagunas, and the Isletas among the Nephites. The Zunis are in advance of the Navajos, Apaches, or any other Lamanites. The Lagunas are much above the Zunis, and the Isletas are far above them all in wealth and beauty, cleanliness, or order of their homes and purses, or persons, the adornment of their dwellings, their industry, indefatigable labors, and their virtue and their purity of their national blood, their bearing and dignity, and their intercourse with strangers, and above all else, the expansion of their minds and their capacity to receive any principle of the gospel, such as endowments or sealing powers, fully equal the minds of any of the Anglo-Saxon race. They have their own laws, police courts, judgment seat. They're very rich. They allow no white man or Mexican to mix with them in their blood. All their marriages are of their own tribe. I look upon the Isletas as the most industrious and hard-laboring people of any I ever met, the Latter-day Saints not excepted. The Nephite village has a field of corn 10 miles in length and 1 in width. It lies north and south of their village and is irrigated. The corn is quite as good as any as I ever saw in Utah and perfectly clean. Not a weed could be found in 100 acres. They have also 21 vineyards bordering on their city and thousands of vines to each vineyard, some of them 60 years of age, all kept perfectly clean and loaded with the finest of fruit and as heavy a crop as I ever saw in St. George. The vines stand from 2 to 4 feet in height and are in the fall of the year. Each vine has a mound of earth formed around it until it is covered out of sight. In the spring it is uncovered and the earth leveled. This is an immense work. They have also many apple, pear, and peach orchards, all ripe, and as well as grapes. Isletas is occupied only by Nephites themselves. There are no Mexicans or white men. The houses generally are made of adobe, cement, concrete, and plastered. The outside walls are white as snow, and the floors are made of mortar, of plaster, very smooth, and many of them neatly carpeted. I found in Isletas and other villages of the Nephites the same kind of crockery and stoneware painted in all its brilliant colors that we find in the remains of their ancient cities or in ruins of the ancient inhabitants. All of their water jugs and main crockery are of this material, for they still hold the art of making and painting it. Woodruff's characterizations of cultural elements he perceives as positive, fine buildings, industry, agriculture, cleanliness, laws, and government, are from his perspective, that of a 19th century Connecticut-born farmer, Nephite, while less positively perceived ones, nomadic lifestyle, warlike nature, are Lamanite. Mormon pioneers who explored the southwestern Rockies were fascinated by Anasazi ruins they found in mountain cliffs, some of which they suppose were built by the Gadianton robbers, which the Book of Mormon describes as a wicked, savage, warlike, and bloodthirsty people who lived in the mountain fastnesses. They attributed others to the Nephites, a civilized, industrious, enterprising people who feared God, dwelt in cities, cultivated the arts and sciences, and occupied a rich, fertile land. Nephites in mid-19th century Mormon perception built cities, cultivated the arts and sciences, and engaged in agriculture. Early settlers in the Salt River Valley region of Arizona encountered pre-Columbian remains of walls and irrigation canals of Hohokam culture. Mormons who settled near Mesa, Arizona, associated these remains with the Nephites. A collection of photographs in the Church History Library taken of undeveloped land near Mesa, Arizona around 1900 by James W. LeSueur is called Ancient Nephite Ruins Near Mesa, Arizona. These show what appear to be the remains of old walls and irrigation canals. One of these is described as a wall surrounding a Nephite castle. Another shows several levees of an old Nephite canal and notes, ancient Nephites had 123 miles of canal systems in Salt River Valley, Arizona. The photographs were taken not far from the early Arizona Mormon settlement of Lehi. In light of this pattern of associating Nephite with civilization, Joseph's references to the plains of the Nephites seems more like a cultural reference than a geographical one. Neville alludes to third-hand accounts in which Joseph identified the area in southern Missouri as the ancient site of Manti, which supports his argument for a North American location. This is based upon a diary entry from Samuel Tyler, who traveled with the Kirtland camp in 1838 to Missouri, not to be confused with the 1834 Zions camp. In Tyler's journal entry for September 25, 1838, he wrote, "We passed through Huntsville County, seat Randolph County, population 450, and 3 miles further we bought 32 bushels of corn and one of the brethren who resides in this place. There are several of the brethren round about here, and this is the ancient site of the city of Manti, which is spoken of in the Book of Mormon, and this is appointed one of the stakes of Zion, and it is in Randolph County, Missouri, 3 miles west of the county seat." Historical analysis of the relevant documents show that Joseph Smith was not present when Tyler made this entry, but was several counties away and far west. The wording about Manti if from Joseph Smith, is not contemporary with the journal entry and may or may not be influenced by hearsay. Tyler does not attribute this wording to Joseph Smith or Revelation. A similar entry, subsequently drafted for the manuscript history of the church, seems to have been essentially based upon the Tyler entry, but was not written until after the death of Joseph Smith, and was not published until 1854 in the Millennial Star. When Andrew Jensen published the entry in the Historical Record in 1888, he added without explanation the words, "which the prophet said," immediately before the sentence about Manti, although this was not in the original manuscript. In 1938, Joseph Fielding Smith published an article in the Deseret News, citing the Tyler Journal and the published Millennial Star version of the manuscript history entry to support an argument for a Missouri location. In 1956, that article, along with many of Smith's sermons and writings, were published without modification in a popular compilation entitled Doctrines of Salvation, through which the idea for an ancient Manti location in Missouri became more widely known in LDS circles. He never spoke on or addressed the issue of Book of Mormon geography after he became president of the church. In an earlier study, I discussed a second important contemporary source, the Elias Smith Journal. This entry, written on the same day, reads, "We came through Huntsville, the county seat of Randolph, where we were told before we arrived there we should be stopped, but saw nothing of the kind when we came through the town, and heard no threats whatever, but all appeared friendly. 1.5 miles west of Huntsville, we crossed the east branch of the Chariton, and 1.5 miles west of the river we found Ira Ames, and some other brethren, near the place where the city of Manti is to be built, and encamped for the night on Dark Creek, 6 miles from Huntsville." Rather than suggest that the ancient site of Manti was in Randolph County, Missouri, the Elias Smith entry indicates plans for a future settlement to be called by that name. B.H. Roberts, in his compilation of the history of the church, incorporated the Elias Smith wording into the entry for that day and did not use either the Tyler Journal or the manuscript history entry. This is how it still stands in the published history of the church today in Volume 3, page 144. I would conclude, based upon the known evidence, that Joseph Smith at some point designated the site in Randolph County as a settlement for a future stake that would be named Manti. The actual words, however, make a difference. The problem is not Joseph Smith's prophetic authority, but our limitations due to the inability to recover what Joseph may have actually said on this point. Did Joseph say it was the ancient site of Manti spoken of in the Book of Mormon, or did he say that it was where the city of Manti is to be built? Do the words in these reports reproduce Joseph's statement word for word? How much does what Tyler and Smith reported in good faith reflect the ideas and speculation of local brethren with whom they interacted? Did they assume on their own, based on the proposed name of the settlement, that it might have been the ancient site of Manti as well? That seems reasonable to me, but who can say? Since Joseph Smith was not present at the time, and the true reports are not the same, we cannot simply put words into the prophet's mouth and conclude that both sources are correct, and one cannot build a reliable geography on such uncertainties. In 1903, a large group of Latter-day Saint students, teachers, and general authorities met in Provo, Utah, to discuss the question of Book of Mormon geography. The organizers thought it might be nice if the group could come to a unified view of the location of Zarahemla mentioned in the Book of Mormon. Differences of opinions were expressed. Some argued that Zarahemla was in South America. Others thought it might have been in Honduras. The news report suggested that some had strongly held opinions about this and other geographical matters and argued forcefully for their respective positions. According to the report, President Joseph F. Smith spoke briefly and expressed the idea that the question of the situation of the city was one of interest certainly, but if it could not be located, the matter was not of vital importance. And if there were differences of opinion on the question, it would not affect the salvation of the people, and he advised against students considering it of so vital importance as the principles of the gospel. Later, he again cautioned students against making the union question, the location of cities and lands, of equal importance with the doctrines contained in the book. President Smith's counsel to not make issues of Book of Mormon geography, such as the location of Zarahemla, a matter of equal importance to the doctrines contained in the Book of Mormon, is consistent with the counsel of current church leaders and provides a notable contrast with advocates of the Heartland theory, such as Meldrum and Neville, and others who falsely accuse those who disagree with their interpretations of dismissing or undermining the prophetic authority of Joseph Smith. In October 1929, President Anthony W. Ivins of the First Presidency said, "There is a great deal of talk about the geography of the Book of Mormon. Where was the land of Zarahemla? Where was the city of Zarahemla and other geographical matters? It does not make any difference to us. There has never been anything yet set forth that definitely settles that question. As you study the Book of Mormon, keep these things in mind, and do not make definite statements concerning things that have not been proven in advance to be true." Recently, some Latter-day Saints, finding a dearth of evidence for a revelation on Book of Mormon geography, have tried to squeeze one from Section 125 of the Doctrine and Covenants. This revelation invited the saints to gather at appointed locations, including settlements in Iowa, where they might build up stakes of Zion. "And let them build up a city unto my name upon the land opposite the city of Nauvoo, and let the name of Zarahemla be named upon it." The revelation says nothing about where the ancient Nephite city of Zarahemla was located, but Neville writes as if he really wished that it had. He suggests that the revelation may have been the Lord's warning to Joseph about Winchester's imminent promulgation of a Mesoamerican approach to promoting the Book of Mormon. He claims that the Zarahemla editorials were a direct challenge to the 1841 revelation in Section 125 about Zarahemla. It is unclear how a Mesoamerican interpretation of Book of Mormon geography could directly challenge something that the revelation does not mention. In a previous article, I observed that the verse says nothing about the location of the ancient site of Zarahemla. That remains the case. As a secondary argument, I had cited several journal entries that apparently called the Iowa settlement Zarahemla before the revelation in Section 125 was given. Based upon the information available to me at that time, this seemed a valid secondary argument. In May 2013, I learned of several apparent anomalies in those sources that suggest these entries, at least the parts mentioning Zarahemla, were likely written later than the dates had suggested to me. I hope at some point in the future to examine the originals myself and revisit the matter. For the present, I will assume those sources do not support my earlier argument. Still, we lack certain specifics on how the revelation was received. Did Joseph Smith and his brethren discuss the matter beforehand? Had they previously considered the name Zarahemla as a possible designation and then submitted it to the Lord for confirmation? The name itself need not have been a geographical clue to hold significance. The name Zarahemla would have reminded the saints in the Book of Mormon and invited them to liken their experiences to those of Lehi's people. When the saints were driven from Missouri, they had to flee from danger and persecution. One of several places they found refuge was in Iowa. In the Book of Mormon, groups of refugees found safety and refuge in Zarahemla. It was a place where those who believed in the scriptures and in the words of the living prophets could gather and receive protection, just as the Latter-day Saints who believed in the words of Joseph Smith and the words of the Book of Mormon prophets could settle. As such, the name seems appropriate. Both Manti and Zarahemla were Book of Mormon cities, but perhaps significantly, they were fortified cities as well. The Lord characterized the first stake in Kirtland as a stronghold, a term that evokes the Iowa settlement's namesake in the Book of Mormon, a place that at times was well fortified. Of course, most stakes in the past and today are not named after Book of Mormon or even biblical locations, but perhaps the Lord thought it fitting in Joseph Smith's day to give these two settlements, Manti in Missouri and Zarahemla in Iowa, names that would remind them and future readers of what a stake of Zion is intended to be, a defense and a refuge for the saints. This admittedly reflects my own thinking and speculation, but it makes more sense, I think, than an approach that tries to force a revelation and geographical interpretation out of a passage where none exists. Neville exaggerates the importance of Benjamin Winchester's writings and underestimates the influence of earlier writers whose work he seems to be unaware. In 1837, Parley P. Pratt published A Voice of Warning, which has been described as the most important of all the non-canonical LDS books of the period. In 1839, Pratt published a second edition, revised and enlarged, which included an expanded section on the Book of Mormon. Givens and Groh note that this pamphlet, which remained among the most widely read Mormon works for several decades after his death, also proved exceptionally effective as a missionary tool. Pratt's writings, which deeply influenced other Mormon authors, particularly his equally prolific younger brother Orson, not only helped convert thousands to Mormonism, but also shaped the Mormon theological system. It was Pratt's greatest theological contribution as a Latter-day Saint, a work that served the Church as its most powerful proselyting tool after the Book of Mormon for more than a century. For the first few years of the Church's existence, little besides the Book of Mormon could ground Mormon theology or expound doctrine, and early Latter-day Saints seldom used the Book of Mormon in that regard. In fact, during this early period of Church history, next to the Book of Mormon itself, Pratt's book soon became the principal vehicle presenting Mormonism to the Latter-day Saint faithful and the general public alike. But for narrative exposition, one that aspired to lay out in readable format, in essence, Mormonism for member and non-Mormon alike, Voice of Warning had no peer, and for many decades, little competition. The first publications Benjamin Winchester produced are two small pamphlets from 1840. Neither addresses the question of Book of Mormon geography. The first of these, an examination of a lecture by the Reverend H. Perkins, is unremarkable. The second, The Origin of the Spalding Theory, had more lasting significance as a response to the Spalding Theory and the information it provided on Dr. Philastrus Hurlbut, whom Winchester knew and claimed as a relative. In 1841, while in Philadelphia, Winchester published a short-lived periodical entitled The Gospel Reflector. This periodical commenced in January 1841 and continued until June 15, 1841 issue, after which it was discontinued. Generally, The Gospel Reflector treats a broad range of doctrinal subjects. The ideas themselves were not new to the Mormon printed record, but their defense marshaled a nearly comprehensive collection of biblical citations and examples, many appearing in a Latter-day Saint publication for the first time. Some of these articles that appeared there were subsequently reprinted in other Latter-day Saint periodicals, such as the Times and Seasons. It also was greatly influenced by earlier Latter-day Saint publications. Like other Mormon periodicals, it borrowed liberally from its predecessors. For example, a chronology showing the creation of Adam exactly 6,000 years before is reprinted from the third number of the Evening and Morning Star. The seventh lecture on faith is from the Doctrine and Covenants. Oliver Cowdery's letters to W.W. Phelps are taken from the first volume of The Messenger and Advocate. Sidney Rigdon's article on the Millennium and his letter to John Whitmer on the New Testament Church are republished from the second volume of The Evening and Morning Star. And the 14th number of The Messenger and Advocate in the final issue is largely made up of abstracts from the Doctrine and Covenants. But Winchester wrote much of the text, and here the influence of Parley Pratt's Voice of Warning, explicitly acknowledged in the first number, is pervasive. Winchester's essays on spiritualizing the scriptures, the kingdom of God, gospel dispensations, continued revelation, the Book of Mormon, the restoration of Israel, the resurrection, and the millennium, all derive from the second edition of Voice of Warning, occasionally borrowing from it verbatim. Of particular interest to the question of Book of Mormon geography are two articles published in the March 1st and March 15th, 1841 issue. Both of these cited biblical proof texts in support of the Book of Mormon and the necessity of modern revelation. In the March 1st article, Winchester introduced the Book of Mormon with a brief account of its recovery from the hill by Joseph Smith, and then referenced reports of various relics of antiquity to prove that America has been inhabited by an enlightened people far in advance of the savage state of the red man of the forest. Winchester also quoted from the work of Elias Boudinot to support the idea that North American Indians were of Israelite origin. In the March 15th issue, Winchester briefly describes Lehi's journey from Jerusalem into the wilderness and then across the ocean to the American land of promise. Winchester indicates that in their final wars, the Nephites fled northward to the hill in New York, where the Nephites were destroyed, and Moroni buried the plates, adding that the Indians of America are descendants of the Lamanites. In 1841, Winchester and Erastus Snow published an address to the citizens of Salem and vicinity. Neville attributes ideas in the Book of Mormon in this pamphlet to Winchester, when the Book of Mormon content was actually taken from Parley Pratt's 1840 publication and addressed by a minister of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to the people of the United States. The bulk of the pamphlet is a summary of Mormon beliefs taken primarily from Orson Pratt's Remarkable Visions and Parley Pratt's An Address to the People of the United States, which is quoted directly at one point and which undoubtedly suggested the title. In its argument that not all of God's revelations are in the Bible, it uses Parley's list of prophetic books referred to but not included in the Bible, which Winchester reprinted twice in the Gospel Reflector. Winchester subsequently published two other works in 1842 and 1843. These included his reference tool Synopsis of the Holy Scriptures and Concordance and his 1843 book A History of the Priesthood from the Beginning of the World to the Present Time. Only the last chapter of A History dealt with the Book of Mormon and is a minor reworking of his earlier Book of Mormon writings from the Gospel Reflector. The limited Mesoamerican geography, according to Neville, was first set out by Benjamin Winchester. This is repeatedly emphasized by the author throughout his book, and in fact provides the primary motive for Neville's imagined conspiracy to get Winchester's work surreptitiously published in the fall of 1842. Winchester summarized the Book of Mormon account in two articles published in March 1841. 600 years B.C., according to the Book of Mormon, Lehi, who was a righteous man, was forewarned of the destruction of Jerusalem in the Babylonish captivity, who was commanded by the Lord, took his family, and fled into the wilderness. They set sail, and in a proper time they landed, as we infer from their record, somewhere on the western coast of South America. They immediately commenced tilling the earth and erecting mansions for dwelling places. They frequently had long and tedious wars with the Lamanites, and were often driven before them. They were constantly emigrating to the north. At length they commenced settlement in the region of country not far from the Isthmus of Darien, and while in those parts they advanced farther in science and arts than at any time previous, and built more spacious cities and buildings than they did before. The Lord, foreseeing that they would not repent, commanded Mormon to collect the writings of his forefathers, their revelations and prophecies, etc., and make an abridgment of them and engrave them upon new plates. Their manner of keeping records was to engrave them on metal plates. But in consequence of their wars and their flight to the north to escape the Lamanites, he did not live to finish this work. And when the final destruction of the Nephites drew near, he gave the records to his son Moroni, who lived to see their final extermination or destruction by the hands of the Lamanites. Moroni was then commanded to deposit this record in the earth. It remained safe in the place where it was deposited till it was brought to light by the administration of angels and translated by the gift and power of God. This deposit was made about the year 420 on a hill then called Cumorah, now in Ontario County, where it was preserved in safety until it was brought to light by no less than the ministry of angels and translated by inspiration. That's Winchester's quote. Here, Neville writes, Winchester establishes the outline of what would be the Mesoamerican theory of Book of Mormon geography. This includes his inference about where Lehi landed and what the author calls the Isthmus of Darien theory. Neville thinks Winchester's approach was new and different because he was the first to make specific ties between Book of Mormon and archaeological findings not only in North America, but also in Central America, including Guatemala, and is the first to assert a Mesoamerican setting for the events in Mormon's text, and the first to link the Book of Mormon to specific Central American sites. All of this is wrong. What Winchester actually describes is not the Mesoamerican view, but the traditional hemispheric interpretation of Book of Mormon geography. This theory placed events of the narrative throughout North and South America. Inherent in the hemispheric model is the obvious assumption that Central America was the narrow neck of land, with a dividing line between the land northward and southward at the Isthmus of Darien in Panama. So the idea of Central America as a setting for at least some events described in the Book of Mormon was always a basic element of the old hemispheric theory. It was not an 1841 innovation of Winchester, as Neville contends. A representative example of this view can be found in Orson Pratt's very popular 1840 missionary pamphlet, interesting account of several remarkable visions, and of the late discovery of an ancient American records. Pratt briefly described the Jaredite story. We learn from this very ancient history that at the confusion of languages, when the Lord scattered the people upon the face of the earth, the Jaredites, being the righteous people, obtained favor in the sight of the Lord and were not confounded. They were marvelously brought across the great deep to the shores of North America. According to the process of time, they became very numerous and a powerful people, occupying principally North America, building large cities in all quarters of the land, being a civilized and enlightened nation. They were entirely destroyed. Pratt then gives an account of the migration of Lehi's colony and their settlement in the land of promise. This remnant of Joseph were also led in a miraculous manner from Jerusalem. They came to the great waters, where by the commandment of God they built a vessel, in which they were safely brought across the great Pacific Ocean, and landed upon the western coast of South America. This remnant of Joseph, soon after they landed, separated themselves into two distinct nations. This division was caused by a certain portion of them being greatly persecuted because of their righteousness. By the remainder, the persecuted nation emigrated northwards to the northern parts of South America, leaving the wicked nation in possession of the middle and southern parts of the same. The former were called Nephites, being led by a prophet whose name was Nephi. The latter were called Lamanites. The Lord gave unto them the whole continent for the land of promise. Arts and sciences flourished to a great extent. Various kinds of machinery were in use. Clothes of various kinds were manufactured, swords, scimitars, axes, various implements of war were made together with head shields, arm shields, breastplates, to defend themselves in battle with their enemies, and in the days of their righteousness they were a civilized, enlightened, and happy people. In their wars with the Lamanites, tens of thousands were very frequently slain, after which they were piled together in great heaps upon the face of the ground, and covered with a shallow covering of earth, which will satisfactorily account for the ancient mounds, filled with human bones so numerous at the present day, both in North and South America. Pratt also describes the Mulekite colony. Another remnant was brought out of Jerusalem, some of whom were descendants of Judah. They landed in North America, soon after which they emigrated into the northern parts of South America, at which place they were discovered by the remnant of Joseph something like 400 years after. The second colony landed in North America and emigrated from thence to the northern parts of South America, and about 400 years after they were discovered by the Nephites. They were called the people of Zarahemla. The Nephites united with them and taught them the Holy Scriptures, and they were restored to civilization and became one nation with them. And in process of time, the Nephites began to build ships near the Isthmus of Darien and launch them forth into the Western Ocean, in which great numbers sailed a great distance to the northward and began to colonize North America. After the time of Christ, as described by Pratt, the people of Lehi fell into wickedness and were destroyed. A great and terrible war commenced between them, which lasted for many years and resulted in the complete overthrow and destruction of the Nephites. This war commenced at the Isthmus of Darien and was very destructive to both nations for many years. At length the Nephites were driven before their enemies a great distance to the north and northeast, and having gathered their whole nation together, both men, women, and children, they encamped on and round about the hill Cumorah, where the records were found, which is in the state of New York. Pratt's popular and influential pamphlet was published a year before Winchester published his own outline of the Book of Mormon narrative in the Gospel Reflector. But similar and earlier descriptions of the hemispheric view can be found in publications from 1830 onward, as reflected in the following examples. This new revelation, they say, is especially designed for the benefit, or rather for the Christianizing of the Aborigines of America, who, as they affirm, are part of the tribe of Manasseh, whose ancestors landed on the coast of Chile 600 years before the coming of Christ. Lehi and his family landed on the coast of South America, where they increased very fast, and the Lord raised up a great many prophets among them. They built cities, encouraged the arts and sciences. The first battle was fought nigh to the Straits of Darien, and the last at the hill called Cumorah, when all the Christians were hewn down but one prophet. 600 years before Christ, a certain prophet called Lehi went out to declare and promulgate the prophecies to come. He came across the water into South America. The last battle that was fought among these parties was on the very ground where the plates were found, but it had been a running battle, for they commenced at the Isthmus of Darien and ended in Manchester. In the Book of Mormon, a remnant of the branches or seed of Joseph are represented as crossing the sea and settling this continent of North and South America. Lehi's family sailed in a southeast direction and landed on the continent of South America in Chile, 30 degrees south latitude. The prophets Lehi and Nephi came out with a colony from Jerusalem in the days of Jeremiah the prophet, and after wandering for 8 years in the wilderness of Arabia, came to the seacoast, built a vessel, and finally landed safely on the coast of what is now called Chile in South America. Lehi's party crossed the ocean, landing on the west coast of Chile, near the place where Valparaiso now stands. They went north and settled in New Granada, but in going north they found people calling themselves the people of Zarahemla, not far from where the city of Cartagena now stands near the Magdalena River, called the Book of Mormon, the Sidon. Lamanites drove the Nephites out of Zarahemla, and the Isthmus of Darien became the dividing line between the two powers. The Nephites were gradually driven north, and at last were totally destroyed near the hill Cumorah in the state of New York about 400 years after Christ. Lehi's people became divided into two nations, had become spread over both North and South America. One of these divisions was called Lamanites and dwelt in the country of South America, and the other division called Nephite in North America. This war commenced at the Isthmus of Darien and was more or less destructive to both nations, until at length the Nephites were driven before their enemies north and northeast to a great distance, when gathering their whole nation together, both men, women, and children, they encamped on and around about the hill Cumorah, near where Palmyra, New York, now stands. Now, Winchester's 1841 reference to the Isthmus of Darien merely reflects a hemispheric view that was known from 1830 and throughout the 19th century. This idea was commonly held. Why would Winchester need to form an elaborate conspiracy to do something that everybody was doing and had been doing since the year the Book of Mormon was published? In his March 1, 1841 article for the Gospel Reflector, Winchester discussed evidence of pre-Columbian antiquities in support of the Book of Mormon. Now, when the antiquarian travels the western wilds, he has the privilege to behold the relics of a once enlightened nation, who understood arts and sciences to some extent. He can there walk upon the ruins of once magnificent cities, abounding in wealth and prosperity, but now depopulated and lying in heaps of massive ruins. And if he is onward with his researches, he gazes upon numerous forts, mounds, obelisks, catacombs, which he marks with wonder and amazement. When he surveys the southern part of North America, he there can feast his mind upon works of antiquity until it is absorbed in contemplating the scenes of destruction that have come upon this nation of the dead and leveled their cities in ruins. In Guatemala, he can survey the ruins of once splendid, beautiful, populous city, perhaps as ever was on the globe. We allude to the city of Otulum near Palenque. And while wandering through these heaps of massive ruins, he beholds the remains of large temples and palaces which exhibit the work of human ingenuity. With closer observation, he discovers a fine display of architectural genius in the construction of these once splendid edifices. And viewing with more avidity still, he beholds in these huge buildings the works of science, an immense quantity of hieroglyphics. He no longer doubts but what America was inhabited by an enlightened nation anterior to its discovery by Columbus. So for Winchester, the Book of Mormon account provided a reasonable explanation for questions that vexed the wondering observer of these ruins. Winchester then cited a description from a report that described them, that described these ruins. Excuse me. The ruins of a city in Central America are among the most striking of such. This city, called Palenque, the name of a town not far off, other antiquarians call it Otulum, lies 250 miles from Tabasco, latitude about 15 degrees north, and there were discovered not such buildings as those erected by the Druids of rough, misshapen stones, but such as those in which kings dwell, built of hewn stones. The appearance of these ruins shows a nation once existed there highly skilled in mechanical arts, and in a state of civilization far beyond anything we've been led to believe of the Aborigines previous to the time of Columbus. A distinguished antiquarian of New York has received from this city a beautiful specimen of the fine arts, an idol of pure gold. This has emphatically been called the Thebes of America. In surveying its ruins, the traveler is led to believe that it was founded at as early a period as the renowned cities of Egypt. How immense this city! It is supposed to have been 60 miles in circumference and that it contained a population of nearly 3 millions. Great were its commercial privileges. Even now the broad and beautiful Otulum rolls along its desolate borders. One of the principal structures revealed to the eye of the antiquarian is the Teuculi, or temple. Its style of architecture resembles the Gothic. It is rude, massive, and durable. Though resembling Egyptian edifices, yet this and other buildings are peculiar and are different from all others hitherto known. The entrance of the temple is on the east side by a portico no more than 100 feet in length and 9 feet broad. The rectangular pillars of the portico have their architraves adorned with stucco work of shields and other devices. The antiquity of this city is manifest not only from its nameless hieroglyphics and other objects, but from the age of some of the trees growing over buildings where once the hum of industry and the voice of merriment was heard. The concentric circles of some of these trees were counted, which showed that they were more than 900 years of age. The antiquities of America spread from the great lakes of the north and the west to Central America and the southern parts of Peru on the south, from the Allegheny Mountains on the east to the Rocky Mountains on the west, and even from the Pacific to the Atlantic Ocean. Winchester then cited another passage from Josiah Priest's American Antiquities. This account, which partly describes the ruins of a stone city 75 miles in circuit, length 32 English miles, greatest breadth 12 miles, full of palaces, monuments, statues, inscriptions, one of the earliest seats of American civilization about equal to Thebes of Egypt, and well calculated to inspire men with hopes that they would throw great light over American history when more properly examined. Winchester concludes this particular argument. We might multiply a catalog of extracts from different authors upon this subject, but we forbear, believing that enough has already been said to convince every candid mind that America has been inhabited previous to its discovery by Europeans, by an enlightened and civilized race of people. However, if anyone should wish to learn farther concerning the antiquities of America, we recommend him to A. Davis' Discovery of America by the Northmen, Josiah Priest's American Antiquities, Mr. Hill, Doe, and Baron Humboldt's Travels in South America. According to Neville, Benjamin Winchester was the first to link the Book of Mormon to specific Central American sites. But this is not the case. Winchester never linked those ruins to any city named in Mormon's account. Winchester's article mentioned the discovery of Otulum, Palenque, to prove, quote, that America had been inhabited by an enlightened people, far in advance of the savage state of the red men of the forest. Earlier writers had been making that argument long before 1841. In April 1833, while preaching in Illinois, Parley P. Pratt and William McClellan reported several encounters with a local Reverend Mr. Peck. In his autobiographical recollection of the encounter, written late years later, Pratt described Peck as a man of note and one of the early settlers of Illinois, and one of its first missionaries. He was also a man of some learning and edited a local newspaper at Rock Spring. In one meeting, Peck attacked the Book of Mormon. According to Pratt, he said there were no ruined cities, buildings, monuments, mounds, fortifications to show existence of such a people as the Book of Mormon described. He said further that the fortifications and mounds of this country were nothing more than works of nature. The following year, Peck published his Gazetteer of Illinois, which described local features of the state, including some of the mounds and fortifications that were subject of local interest. We do not have the words he spoke to Pratt and McClellan during his 1833 lectures, but the following extracts from his 1834 work suggest the kinds of arguments Latter-day Saints might have expected from a relatively informed critic of the time when they mentioned Midwestern mounds as evidence for the Book of Mormon. The existence of mounds in this and other Western states has been assumed as substantial proof amounting to demonstration of a race of men of enterprising habits and far more civilized than the present race of Aborigines. But it is now seriously questioned whether these mounds are the work of art. I know not that any writer ever ventured to attack the supposition till John Russell, Esquire, sent forth his essay in the Illinois Magazine of March 1831. Mr. Russell is a citizen of this state and well known as a writer of considerable talents and literary acquirements. He has had opportunity of examining for himself many of those mounds of various dimensions. He maintains they are not artificial and offers objections to their being productions of human art, not easily obviated. But there are mounds in the West that exactly correspond in shape with these supposed antiquities, and yet from their size most evidently were not made by man. Of one thing the writer is satisfied, that very imperfect and incorrect data have been relied upon and very erroneous conclusions drawn upon Western antiquities. Whoever has time and patience and is in other respects qualified to explore this field of science will use his spade and eyes together and restrain his imagination from running riot among the mounds, fortifications, horseshoes, medals, and whole cabinets of relics of the olden time, will find very little more than the indications of rude savages, the ancestors of the present race of Indians. Of ancient military works, I have long been convinced that not half a dozen such structures ever existed in the West before visits of Europeans. Enclosures of various size and perhaps for different purposes, with an embankment of earth 3 or 4 feet high and a trifling ditch out of which the earth was dug, undoubtedly were formed. In all probability, some of these embankments enclosed their villages, others by the residence of their chiefs or headmen. But what people, savage, barbarous, civilized, or enlightened, ever constructed a fortification around 500 or 600 acres with a ditch on the inside? Or what military people made 20 or 30 such forts within 2 or 3 miles? At any rate, I am confident these immense armies of military heroes never visited Illinois. Those who are particularly desirous of information concerning the millions of warriors and the bloody battles in which more were slain than ever fell in all the wars of Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon, with a particular description of their military works, would do well to read the Book of Mormon, made out of the golden plates of that distinguished antiquarian Joe Smith. It is far superior to some modern productions on Western antiquities because it furnishes us with the names and biography of the principal men who were concerned in these enterprises, with many of the particulars of their wars for several centuries. But seriously, the attention of scientific men is invited to this subject. Now, Parley Pratt recalled responding to Peck's argument as follows. To do away with the Book of Mormon, we are called upon to believe that the temples, statues, pyramids, sculptures, monuments, engravings, mounds, and fortifications, now in ruins on the American continent, are all the works of nature in her playful moments, that the bones of slumbering nations were never clothed upon with flesh, and that their sleeping dust was never animated with life. This is too monstrous. It is too marvelous, too miraculous for our credulity. We can never believe that these things are the works of nature, unaided by human art. We are not so fond of the marvelous. Pratt's rebuttal suggested that by 1833, Mormon arguments for pre-Columbian civilization were expanding to include evidence from Central America as well as the North American Midwest. Just months before the encounter, the February 1833 issue of the Evening and Morning Star published a report of the ruined city of Palenque. The report cited an extract from the London Literary Gazette describing a city and its suburbs with buildings and statues of stone, and monumental inscriptions and other evidence of civilization prior to the 14th century. The editor, W.W. Phelps, considered it good testimony for the Book of Mormon. He also suggested that should ruins of many cities be discovered, it would be no more than a confirmation of what was once on this land of the Lord. Pratt's reference to statues, sculptures, monuments, and engravings is consistent with the content of that report and suggests that he was familiar with the article in the Evening and Morning Star and used it to supplement his rebuttal to Peck's claim that there were no ruined pre-Columbian cities in America. In his 1839 revised and expanded version of A Voice of Warning, Pratt introduced passages from Josiah Priest's American Antiquities, which describe the remains of Palenque, the same passage cited later by Winchester in the Gospel Reflector in 1841. Pratt's 1839 edition, as noted already, was extremely popular and widely distributed. He also referenced another description of the ruined city published in the Family Magazine in 1833. It is stated in the Family Magazine, number 34, page 266 for 1833, as follows. Public attention has recently excited respecting the ruins of an ancient city found in Guatemala. It would seem that these ruins are now being explored, and much curious and valuable matter in the literary and historical point of view is anticipated. We deem the present a most auspicious moment, now that the public attention is turned to the subject, and to spread its contents before our readers as an introduction to future discoveries during the researches now in progress. The following are some of the particulars as related by Captain Del Rio, who partially examined them, as above related, 1787. From Palenque, the last town northward in the province of Ciudad Real de Chiapa, taking a southwesterly direction and ascending a ridge of highland that divides the kingdom of Guatemala from Yucatan at a distance of 6 miles, is the little river Micol, whose waters flow in a western direction and unite with the great river Tolija, which bends its course toward the province of Tabasco. Having passed Micol, the ascent begins, and at half a league, or a mile and a half, the traveler crosses a little stream called Otulum. From this point, heaps of stones and ruins are discovered, which render the roads very difficult for another half league. When you gain the height whereon the stone houses are situated, being still 14 in number in one place, some more dilapidated than others, yet still having many of their apartments perfectly discernible. A rectangular area 300 yards in breadth by 450 in length, which is a fraction over 56 rods wide and 84 rods long, being in the whole circuit 280 rods, which is 3/4 of a mile and a trifle over. This area presents a plain at a base of the highest mountain forming the ridge. In the center of this plain is situated the largest of the structures which has been yet discovered among these ruins. It stands on a mound or pyramid 20 years high, which is 60 feet or nearly 4 rods in a perpendicular altitude, which gives it a lofty and beautiful majesty as if it were a temple suspended in the sky. This is surrounded by other edifices, namely 5 to the northward and 4 to the southward, and 1 to the southwest and 3 to the eastward, 14 in all. In all directions, the fragments of other fallen buildings are seen extending along the mountain that stretches east and west, either way from these buildings, as if they were a great temple of worship, or their government house around which they built their city, and where dwelt their kings and officers of state. At this place was found a subterranean stone aqueduct of great solidity and durability, which in its course passes beneath the largest building. Let it be understood, this city of Otulum, the ruins of which are so immense, is in North, not South America, in the same latitude with the island of Jamaica, which is about 18 degrees north of the equator, being on the highest ground between the northern end of the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean, where the continent narrows toward the Isthmus of Darien and is about 800 miles south of New Orleans. The discovery of these ruins, and also of many others equally wonderful in the same country, are just commencing to arouse the attention of the schools of Europe, who hitherto have denied that America could boast of her antiquities. But these immense ruins are now being explored under the direction of scientific persons, a history of which in detail will be forthcoming, doubtless, in due time, 2 volumes of which, in manuscript, we are informed, have already been written and cannot but be received with enthusiasm by Americans. We might fill a volume with accounts of American antiquities, all going to show that this country has been peopled with a people who possessed a knowledge of the arts and sciences, who built cities, cultivated the earth, and who were in possession of a written language. The notion of a ruined city in Central America reminded Pratt of the account of the destruction in 3rd Nephi, which he suggested might provide a reasonable explanation for the ruins. In the spring of 1840, an anonymous critic who described himself as a philanthropist of Chester County published a pamphlet attacking the Book of Mormon and the Mormons. This Book of Mormon, he wrote, presupposes among the Indians at the time of its compilation and engraving a knowledge of the arts and sciences, reading, writing, engraving, gold beating, etc. But the present race of Indians have no recollection or tradition of reading or writing ever being among them. Shortly thereafter, S. Bennett, a Latter-day Saint of Philadelphia, published a reply. Anyone who has the slightest acquaintance with American antiquities or Indian traditions will find abundant evidence to establish the fact. See Priest's American Antiquities, also a work on the discovery of America by the Northmen by A. Davis. The philanthropist was unimpressed with mound builder evidence. 1,000 opinions, sir, concerning the aborigines of this country is not proof of the truth of the book. But are there not mounds, forts, and remains of towns that show that the inhabitants of this country were once acquainted with the arts and sciences? I answer that these remains will not prove any greater degree of perfection in the arts than that which has existed among the Mexicans when first visited by the Spanish. No remains of antiquity which can be proved to be the works of the inhabitants of this country previous to its discovery will constitute even so much as a shadow of proof that the sciences of reading and writing were ever known here. If the Indians were of Israel, the critic reasoned, they would not have forgotten the arts and sciences of civilization. Winchester wrote several letters reporting his missionary activities in 1839, 1840, and 1841. The two separate pamphlets, he also published two separate pamphlets in 1840, but none of these addressed the question of pre-Columbian antiquities. He never wrote about the subject until March 1841. At that time, he mentioned reports of the ruins of Utulum as evidence for pre-Columbian civilization, like earlier writers, but drew no correlation between that site and any city named in the Book of Mormon text. Winchester's 1841 writings show no awareness of Stevens and Catherwood's discoveries, suggesting that he only learned of them later. Neville thinks that Winchester may have co-authored several reports of George Adams' lectures that were published in the Bostonian in 1842 and reprinted in the Times and Seasons. The most significant of these was reprinted in September 1, 1842 issue. It reports that Adams introduced an account of many American antiquities, together with the discoveries lately made by Mr. Stevens, that all go to prove that the American Indians were once an enlightened people and understood the arts and sciences, as the ruined cities and monuments lately discovered fully prove. If, as Neville suggests, Winchester wrote or co-authored this report, it is a description of Adams' arguments, not Winchester's, and Adams did not link specific Central American cities with those in the Book of Mormon. Winchester only reports that he mentioned Stevens to refute the civilization argument against the Book of Mormon, which missionaries had been doing for years. The idea that Winchester would need to be secretive about getting his writings in the Book of Mormon into print also seems unlikely when we remember that he had no difficulty publishing books in 1842 and 1843. What was to stop him from expressing his views? A History of Priesthood, published in 1843, has an entire chapter on the Book of Mormon. Here was an excellent opportunity to disseminate his views, but the chapter is little more than a reworking of his 1841 writings with a few minor changes. In 1841, he wrote that Lehi landed somewhere on the western coast of South America. In 1843, he wrote ambiguously that they safely landed upon this land. In 1843, he wrote ambiguously that they landed safely upon this land. His 1843 geographical perspective, like that in 1841, was still broad and hemispheric. He mentioned Central American discoveries in both his 1841 and 1843 writings, but in 1841 he could only quote from the older, less reliable reports about Utulum, not from Stevens and Catherwood's more recent and accurate volumes. In 1843 he still wrote vaguely of the remains of these cities and temples that are to be seen in Central America and elsewhere in both north and south parts of the continent, the discovery of which has excited the curiosity and astonishment of the learned so much of late. The ruins were evidence for civilization, but he drew no correlation between them and specific Book of Mormon cities. His failure to mention Stevens or Catherwood by name or reference any actual details from their 1841 or 1843 books, not even so much as a page number, suggests only superficial knowledge, and that even by 1843, Winchester's geographical conceptions of the Book of Mormon had not changed much since 1841. The 1842 report of the Boston lecture shows that he had heard of the discoveries by then, but never made much use of them, if his writings are any indication. Neville, in fact, presents no evidence that Winchester owned or so much as read Stevens and Catherwood, yet this is the man who we are to believe wrote the unsigned 1842 editorials on Central America in the Times and Seasons. For the purported mastermind of the Mesoamerican idea of Book of Mormon geography, that seems odd, to say the least. The evidence from Winchester's known writings strongly weigh against such a theory. Neville's Winchester is a fairy tale figure, the evil genius behind the limited Mesoamerican geography, an idea that originated in the rotten heart of a dissident, was promoted by apostates, and beguiles our thinking about the Book of Mormon. It is Mark the Church, but hopefully not forever, he says. He pursues the accused with zeal, determination, and creativity to find means, motive, and opportunity for what turns out to be an imaginary crime, a scheme where none was needed to publish ideas that were never controversial. He really has no idea what a Mesoamerican geography is, He just knows that he's against it. This has been a recording of The Treason of the Geographers, Mythical Mesoamerican Conspiracy in the Book of Mormon by Matthew Roper, originally published in Interpreter, a Journal of Mormon Scripture, Volume 16, 2015, pages 161 to 205, read by Matthew Roper. This audio recording is copyrighted under a Creative Commons license and may be freely distributed if it remains unchanged. The journal and its website are credited and is for non-commercial use. A printed version of this and many other articles and resources on Mormon Scripture can be found at mormoninterpreter.com.